Good evening, everyone. My name is Ollie Olerenshaw and I'm a very, very grateful alcoholic. My home group is the Canberra Speakers Group. We meet on a Saturday night in Canberra. Canberra, for those of you who are international, Canberra is the capital city of Australia. We meet Saturday nights at 7 o'clock. And it's a great meeting. And if you're ever coming to Australia, or if you're in Australia and you're coming to Canberra, please let us know. You know, we're always looking for people to speak at the meeting. It's we also meet on a Tuesday night. We have a steps meeting, which we run then as well. It's such an honour to have been asked to speak tonight. I've been getting quite nervous leading up to the to tonight. Though, well, just now. So I hope you'll bear with me. I always like to say that I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being an alcoholic and I love my life today. Some people might be horrified at hearing that. And it's certainly true that I've not always been able to say that I like being an alcoholic. In fact, when I came to AA, I rather didn't like being an alcoholic and really, really wished that I wasn't one, even though when I first came to AA, I had pretty much accepted that I was an alcoholic at that time and that I'm still one, of course. I came to AA in Melbourne, Australia in 1992. It was the March 1992. I went to a meeting and it was a very important experience because I had been told by a psychiatrist that I was an alcoholic, and oddly enough I kind of accepted that because it explained why I drank so much. It was quite a different experience to go into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and listen to other people who were not professionals just talk about being alcoholics. And, you know, I think I really felt I belonged. From the beginning, I somehow knew I was in the right place. I didn't get sober straight away, though. I mucked around with other drugs, and I would drink occasionally for the first 18 months. So you'll notice, on my nickname, it says Ollie 1893. Well, 1893 is my sobriety date. So I was mucking around for 18 months. Unable to stay sober, but even there, you know, it's funny how I still knew I was in the right place, and I did keep coming back. People said keep coming back, and I kept going back. And you know, the strange thing is that coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't come into AA through a rehab. It was just I just knew I was in the right place, and you know, my rock bottom was a very hard one. Even though not as desperate as some that I've heard, but my rock bottom was really an emotional one. You know, I was the unhappiest soul on the planet as far as I was concerned. You know, that saying in the big book, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization was my state of mind. And even though I hadn't lost everything around me, my state of mind was just in hell, and I urgently and desperately wanted and needed that to change. I grew up in a fairly well-to-do family. I believe, you know, it's not for me to say, but I believe my mother suffered from this disease, and I know that she had a terrible, terrible struggle. I don't know if the struggle was trying to stay sober. I think her struggle was just how to live life. My brother tells me that he took her to an AA meeting once, but she didn't stay. And I know that she was heavily medicated, and I know that she had a very good doctor who, you know, really wanted to try and help her and did. But, you know, I know my mother had a lot of problems. But that said, you know, my father was a professional man, and I was given a very good schooling and you know, had all the opportunities that one could want, you know. But I went to a boarding school. By the time I know I picked up my first drink when I was about 13, and I was staying with a friend. He came to boarding school too, and it was the holiday period, so we went and stayed with his at his place Now, his parents owned a pub, a hotel, and so we were staying there, and we were upstairs in the hotel, and I can't remember how it happened. We're like 13 years old, and I can't remember how it happened, but he managed to get hold of a couple of cans of beer, and so we drank the beer, and we just had one each, and it's interesting that my immediate reaction after having that one beer was, I wanted another one. So that's kind of tells me that I was an alcoholic from day one. Even though we didn't have another one, we couldn't get another one, I wanted another one. And my experience, from then on pretty much was that I always wanted more, and that one was never enough. And it was very rare that I would only have one drink. And if I did only have one drink, it was only, again, similar situation where I'm in a position where I just can't, for whatever reason, get another one. But I always wanted more. I left boarding school, and because boarding school is such a disciplined environment. I mean, I did drink when I was at boarding school. I used to go out on Saturday nights and But I managed not to get caught somehow. But certainly when I left boarding school, I was 17, and my primary purpose in life was to just drink. I went to university, but my primary purpose was to drink, and that's what I did. And I got trashed, and I have a strong memory of, being about 18 or 19 years old and sitting on the steps of the pub waiting for it to open one morning. And I remember when I had that, when I remembered that, because prior to that I'd thought, oh, I didn't drink in the morning that often, but there were plenty of times when I did, and when I would just hang out for a drink. Blackouts were a common occurrence in my life right from the beginning. I would go out and all sorts of, and drink, and I would find myself probably at home the next day, and just be wondering what the hell happened the night before, and in that terrible situation where you want to know but you don't want to know. You don't want to know what happened, but you urgently do want to know what happened. And I so I would ring somebody, and say, well, what happened last night? And the awful thing about blackouts was that people would say to me things like, and I can't remember specifically what, but they would say, do you know you said that to so and so last night? And I would think, I've never thought that in my life. Why would I say that to somebody? I couldn't have, but apparently I did. And it was the same with my behaviour. My behaviour would be very bad, or even violent and in a blackout, and I couldn't comprehend, because I'm not a particularly violent person. I wasn't particularly violent all the time when I drank. Occasionally I was, but so it would surprise me that what I've been told in blackout that I've done in blackouts. So I'm absolutely, I belong here. I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being here. I'm glad I'm here. I meant to say, we've just experienced Founders Day, which was on Wednesday, and I'm sure it's been happening in the States, probably in Britain as well, and certainly here in Australia, here in Canberra, we celebrated Founders Day on Monday, and just yesterday I went to a city near Sydney called Wollongong, and they celebrated their Founders Day there yesterday, and I had the honour of getting to talk on the founders and AA history. That was a wonderful experience. So I feel sort of extra privileged that I get to talk in, so close to Founders Day. As I say, I really am in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Just also to say, I'm so impressed with this meeting and the fellowship that you demonstrate in here. As you know, I haven't been coming to these meetings for very long in online. I'm over 15 years sober, but I've only just discovered online meetings, and I actually want to thank Jethro for that. He helped me to get online when I was actually quarantined at home with suspected swine flu, which I didn't have and don't have. Had been quarantined for some time, hadn't been able to get to a meeting, and Jethro helped set me up and find me this meeting, and I can't tell you how important that was and how valuable that was at the time. I was really in need of a meeting, and this meeting was there here, and so I just want to thank you for being here, you know. Now, I haven't talked about Gordy. Gordy actually plays a very significant part in my recovery, and I'll get to that in a minute. I had been going to meetings in for about 4 years, and I sobered up in 1993, and again was very grateful to be sober. And I tell this story because I think it's very important. It's very important. My experience here in helping me to understand what it means to be an alcoholic, and how the disease of alcoholism works or has worked in my life. So I was sober for 4 years, and I was studying at university, and I put my studies on hold because my father was very ill, and I went to visit him. And he asked me to go and stay with him. He was very ill, and he was dying. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to go and spend time with him and to look after him until his dying day, and to actually be with him when he died. So I was sober. I was going to meetings, but I was having a few problems, and they weren't problems which people in meetings seemed to be able to help me with. Well, the meetings I was going to anyway. My father died, and I went. I had some time, and I had a little bit of money up, in my pocket, and so I went for a drive up to a place called Darwin, which is in the north of Australia, right in the centre. It was a very long drive because I'd been in South Australia with my father. In a town called Renmark, and so if those of you can picture a map of Australia, I was effectively at the bottom in the middle, and I drove straight up through the middle of Australia right to the very top. And I guess that distance is probably similar to driving from the bottom of the United States to the top of the United States. It's probably a similar distance. So I went there, and I was absolutely obsessed. Now, it wasn't simply the grief that I was experiencing of my father's death. There was a lot more to it than that. And obsessed with things I won't go into here, but it was very troubling. And the reason this experience is so important is that it very, very nearly led me back to a drink. I was so restless, irritable, and discontent. I was so unhappy, and I was still doing meetings, and I couldn't for the life of me work out what was wrong. And I'd had all sorts of people suggest all sorts of solutions, and including other fellowships and all that kind of thing. And I'm not dismissing the need or the use of other fellowships. I just found it wasn't working on for me, and I was committed, and still am, but was very committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and wasn't going to leave AA, but found myself in Darwin in this desperate situation. Really, I think I was probably about a day or two away from picking up a drink. And remember, I'm 4 years sober at this stage. 4 years dry, really. And I went to what's called the Darwin Roundup, and the week before the Darwin Roundup, they have a camp, at a river there. I think they call it the Bill Wilson Weekend now. I'm not sure. This is in 1997, and I met a man there who Gordy knows well, and he's now living in Perth, and his name is Robin, and he just wandered over. You know, we're all got tents pitched and things, and he wandered over to me, and he said, "Oh, you know, how are you going?" And I think I just sort of broke down and blurted out how awful my life was and how, you know, how terrible things were for me. And he just sort of looked at me, and this is my memory of it, you know. He looked at me and he said, "You know," he said, "you're suffering from untreated alcoholism." And I didn't understand for a moment. I didn't understand what he meant. I didn't know that was possible, considering that we were actually at an AA camp, and you know, I was doing lots of AA. But I knew that something was wrong. So he said, "You're suffering from untreated alcoholism, and you know, and you need to take the steps." And I didn't understand that either, because I thought, well, you know, I go to steps meetings, isn't that enough, kind of thing. Anyway, I watched this guy for a while. I was a bit resentful at what he'd said to me, and I watched him for a while, and you know, he really had something, and he was saying things in meetings that kind of made sense. Anyway, I asked him to sponsor me, and I had actually asked a few people earlier to sponsor me, you know, in earlier times, but it hadn't really worked out. So I asked him to sponsor me, and he said yes, he would, and he began to, you know, sit down with me and read through the big book, and you know, that book came alive in ways that I just I'm astonished at. I remember when Jethro was the speaker a couple of weeks ago, he you know, he described the steps and the process of going through the steps, and this too was my experience. So Robin took me through the, and Robin had been very influenced by Joe and Charlie, and I hadn't heard them at this stage, but Robin took me through the big book, and he said to me, "Okay, we're going to work on step one, and we're going to learn about what's actually wrong with you." You know, step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And he, in taking me through the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and well, the doctor's opinion in particular, described to me the idea of the physical allergy. And I'd never really understood. You know, people had said that alcoholism is a physical and a mental, a twofold or threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. And I had never really understood what that meant. And so he described the physical part of the disease, about the physical allergy, the allergy to alcohol. And suddenly I you know, I understood why we drink so much and why we can't stop. I mean, that all of a sudden made sense. And then we went through Bill's story, and I could at last identify with Bill. I had read the big book before a couple of times, but somehow going through it with him, it came alive in ways that I'd never seen. So we went through Bill's story, and I could identify with Bill. I could, you know, this stock speculator from the 1930s, with whom I thought I had really nothing in common, but I began to identify with his thinking, with the thinking that he describes in his story. And then Robin took me through the there is a solution, and emphasized that there is a solution. And what was, you know, I was in a state where I absolutely needed a solution, And what was important about this experience too was that I wasn't drinking. You know, I didn't have a drinking problem. But I was absolutely insane. I think somewhere in our literature it describes, Bill Wilson talks about being stark raving sober. And that's the way I was. And I just want to emphasize again, I have no doubt that I was within a day or two of picking up a drink. And that's why this experience is so important. I didn't have to pick up a drink because I was at a point where, you know, call it when the pupil is ready, the teacher appears. And for me, I was ready. I was ripe. The teacher appeared. And so he took me through, there is a solution, more about alcoholism and we agnostics. And he called this, you know, just for argument's sake, step two. And, you know, it was describing what the solution is and that the solution was a vital spiritual experience. You know, to have a conscious relationship with a higher power. I didn't have a problem with God. I didn't have a problem with a higher power. I had been in AA for 4 years, and that was long enough to convince me that you know, I needed a higher power in my life. I was happy to pray to that higher power. But because I hadn't done anything about the steps, I was still very resentful. The front of my head, you know, the mind was just very conscious of me having done a lot of harm and yet having no real way to make amends. Now, I'd seen the ninth step there, but I didn't know really how to go and apologize to the people that I'd harmed. And I was living with that guilt. I think I'd discovered by that time that saying sorry was not sufficient. I was still guilty and I was still, you know, really doing the same things. Anyway, so I had all these resentments and fears and harms that I was just so very conscious of and didn't know what to do with. And I really didn't understand until I did it that, you know, the steps clean this stuff up. And up to this point, I'd heard things like, you know, take the steps off the wall and put them into your life. But I hadn't actually been shown how to do that. I thought it was just kind of an osmosis thing. They would just get into me and I'd be fine. But it wasn't working like that, even though I was doing many, many meetings and being very active in AA. So We got to chapter 5, which was read out tonight, it gets to a point where you know, Leslie read it out. You know, we were now at step 3, and we got down on our knees and together, and there was another chap with us called Bull, who I know Gordy will know, and we were in a sort of demountable hut right in the middle of Australia. At this point we were driving back from Darwin back down to South Australia, and this is all happening on a road trip, you know. So we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer together. Now I have to tell you that I was concerned, I was a bit worried about taking this third step. I was very nervous about it. I wasn't sure, but the desperation in me, the desperation to change, the desperation not to drink was so strong, I just did it anyway. And so we got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And then, you know, the big book says next. And that's a time reference. You know, it says next. We launched out on a course of vigorous action, and my sponsor got me writing a fourth step resentment list straight away. And so I have a vivid memory of sitting in my car with this other woman who was traveling with us. She was driving my car, I'm sitting in the passenger seat, and I've got this pad on my knees and I'm just writing name after name after name after name after name after name of all these people that I resent and am angry with. I think it took me about 2 days, and I think I came up with about 70 names, and I still hadn't finished it. I think in the end I ended up with about 90 names of people I resented. And I'm just so grateful that I was given such clear directions on how to do this. And then, you know, he would say, okay, if you finish that column, you can go on to the next one. You know, the columns as they're described in chapter 5 in the big book. And so, you know, I would go on to the next column. But he made me let him know when I'd finished each column so that he, you know, could describe to me how to move on to the next column. And very grateful for that. So we went, to cut a long story short, I finished writing that fourth step, and by the time I'd finished that, I'd written down my resentments, I'd written down my fears, and I'd written down my harms, including sexual harm. And, you know, it wasn't that difficult to do with the guidance that I had. And up to that point, I think I'd attempted a fourth step in the past, and what I'd done was just written an autobiography. I'd written all the dirty, rotten, stinking things that I'd done and everything I felt guilty about, and I'd read it to somebody. Now, I've heard that, you know, for many people that works and that was sufficient, and you know, that's fantastic. I know that that didn't work for me, and I needed a much more formal, if you like, or coordinated approach to the fourth step. I mean, it was just as it's suggested in the big book, and so we went through the fifth step, and that took some time, because he was working, and so we would just grab what time he had, and he took me through the fifth step. Now, it was during that fifth step that my eyes really began to open. Not during the fourth. I was just writing names and things next to the names, and then how things affected me, and I was doing them down the column, so I wasn't really, I was beginning to see a picture, there's no doubt about it. But during the fifth step, my eyes really began to open. And for those of you who are approaching a fifth step, I know I had to pray my way through the fifth step. It wasn't easy. It was very simple, but it wasn't easy. But as we went through it, you know, a pattern began to emerge that I pretty much wanted to control just about everyone in my life, and I began to see a lot of defects of character that, and what they ended up being was pretty much what I was accusing other people of doing, and or you know, what other people had done to me. I found that I had done those things too, and so my eyes really began to open, and I began to see the world in a very, very different way, in a very different light, and I can't tell you the relief that I felt. Now, it wasn't, once I finished the fifth step, it wasn't so much like a huge burden had been lifted. It was more that I just felt empty, because my life had been so centered around my resentments and my fears and my harms, that these were the things that occupied my mind most of the time, and my studies. So when all of those things were effectively removed in a fifth step, I'm just empty. And I don't know what to think, because all my thinking before has been sort of self-centered, resentment-centered, harm-centered. They did this to me, you know, or I did this to them. And now that those things had effectively been removed, I was a bit of an empty shell, but it was a great relief. And my sponsor then sat down with me, and we went through my defects of character and knelt again and asked for those to be removed. With step seven very much being about, you know, practicing the opposite of my defect, so that in very simple terms, you know, if I don't want to do something, it's probably good for me to do it. If I do want to do something, it's probably good for me not to do it. And an example is, if I don't want to go to a meeting, it's usually good for me to go to a meeting. If I don't want to make my bed, it's good for me to make my bed. You know, if I want to launch out on a great romantic relationship, well, it's probably not a good idea in that context. Although, you know, I with that kind of stuff, I don't know, I work closely with my sponsor. So we went through, we asked those defects to be removed, and then in step eight, we'd actually begun constructing a list of harms when in my fifth step, and that my each time it was obvious that I'd done a harm, or it was obvious to my sponsor that I'd done a harm, he would get me to put an A next to each name, so that we were actually constructing the harms list as we went through the fifth step. And I know, you know, we note in the big book that it says when we in the step eight part, it says, you know, we have a list of people we've harmed. We made it when we took inventory, and that was my experience. And I'm just so grateful that my sponsor just stuck to the big book, because when we got to that part, he says, "Well, we've got that list, haven't we?" I said, "Yes, we have." And so what we did was pulled out all the names that had an A next to them and put those into a list. And then we talked about the harm that was done, and we talked about the amends that needs to be made. Again, very grateful that I was given such clear direction on how to approach amends. My sponsor also gave me a little template so that I could write out my amends, and if need be, I could read it to the person that I was making amends to. I think it was better for me to read it at the risk of seeming a bit ingenuous, but it was better for me to read it than make a hash of it. So, and I didn't read them all, but I certainly did some of them where I was a bit worried or a bit scared or worried that I wasn't going to say the right thing. And the template kind of went like this. It says, you know, I'm an alcoholic in recovery, or if that wasn't appropriate, I wouldn't say that. I'd just say, I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and as part of my recovery program, it's essential that I make amends to those people I've harmed. And I believe I've harmed you in the following way. And I'd say, you know, I drank all your alcohol, or I broke all your wine glasses, your fine wine glasses, and or, you know, I stole money from you, and so I would say, I believe I've harmed you in the following way. I would say what I did, and then I would say, before asking your forgiveness, I need to ask you how my actions have affected you. And it was very important for me to hear from them how I had harmed them. And it may seem like a bit of a beat up, but it was actually a very valuable experience for me to really know at depth how I had harmed people. Some people were, you know, when I did this, some people were very frank. They said, "Oh, well, yes, you did harm me, and it really did hurt what you did." Or others would say, "Oh, look, you know, we weren't even aware of it," or "No, you know, it's fine. Don't worry about it." I got all sorts of different responses, and I, you know, Bill Wilson describes somebody kicking, you know, you might get kicked out of somebody's office. Well, that hasn't happened. I did have one person just tell me, as I said, honestly, how I had hurt him. But otherwise, you know, my amends were only ever constructive, and people were astonished, actually, because it doesn't happen that often. And a lot of people are just astonished when we make amends to them. And you know what I love about the amends that we make is that we can make it, as you know, because it's where it is in the steps, you know, around at step nine, we've done all this work before leading up to it, and that work ensures, I believe, it ensures that we don't have to repeat that behavior again, and that finally I can make an amends which is sincere, and which I guess the other thing is that you know, I don't say I'm sorry anymore. Sorry lost any kind of value a long time ago, because I would bleat sorry a lot. And I would actually say that I was wrong. And so to finish my little template, I would say, you know, before asking your forgiveness, I need to ask you how my actions have affected you. And then they would speak, and then I would say, I ask for your forgiveness, and I pray that my actions will never be repeated. And, you know, that was fairly quick, fairly short, and to the point. So then when I left my sponsor, I actually lived at his house for about 3 months as we went through this process. Might not have been that long. This is 97. It's a bit hazy, but and that was an extraordinary thing. And I know it's not recommended that in the big book that people allow us to stay at their places for long, but this really worked. And, I was talking to Robin the other day about this and just how extraordinary it was that it really did work. And I think, you know, I'm not necessarily recommending it, but it was the circumstance we were in. And I had the time, and Robin just thought it was best that I stay with him. So then we went through steps 10, 11 and 12 in the big book. We read through those very carefully, and then he took me through a vision for you. I just can't emphasize how grateful I am for that process. Now, I think what was so important about that experience was that it made it very clear to me how to take other people through the steps. And I'm not saying I know the best way to take people through the steps, or that this is the only way to take people through the steps. I'm looking to learn new and more effective ways to take people through the steps. But I just know that now, that from that point, my sponsor got me to sponsor people. And, you know, I've sponsored a lot of people in that time. And the fact is that many of them are not sober today. Some of them are not even alive today. Some have died of, you know, with needles up their arms, or just, you know, died tragic alcoholic deaths. And I guess the point is that I don't save people's lives. I'm not in that business. I just take people through the steps, and they either get it or they don't, I guess. And, that's part of the tragedy of alcoholism. But the important thing is also, I guess, just to come back to the founders, to remember that Bill Wilson didn't sober anyone up for his first 6 months. And his wife Lois, I think he was complaining to Lois that he had been sober 6 months and no one had gotten sober. And she just looked at him and said, "But Bill, you are sober." And it proves again, and this is my experience now, that by working with other alcoholics, we get to stay sober ourselves. And I will often say this to people I sponsor, you know, you may not stay sober from this, but by me working with you, I get to stay sober. So I sincerely hope that, you know, the people that I take through the steps get through them and start working with others. And I've had the good fortune to see that happen. And I can't tell you how exciting that is, just to see people become free by going through the steps, you know, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also a very active in AA service, and I've had the privilege of serving as an area delegate here in Australia, and that's been an extraordinary experience. I have a different sponsor today, and my current sponsor lives in San Jose in California, and he's very, very active in AA service, and I've had the benefit of his experience to help me with AA service here. It's for all these reasons that I say that I love alcohol. I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I love being an alcoholic today. I truly do live a life beyond my wildest dreams. It isn't perfect. It's far from perfect. And there are all sorts of things going on in my life at the moment. They're good things, but they're not necessarily what I want. I mean, but I realize that today I'm God's, you know, I'm here to do God's will. And that isn't necessarily always what I want to do. But I, I just want to emphasize the importance of the 12 traditions, and I'm so glad that this meeting reads the 12 traditions. They too are, another set of principles beside the steps by which we can live, from which we can learn on a personal basis, and but also which guide us in our meetings. And the often not mentioned are, the 12 concepts for world service. And they too are an extraordinary set of principles. They're really, they can be pretty difficult to get your head around. And for those who are new, if you're having trouble sleeping, have a look at the 12 concepts. I'll put you to sleep. But once you get involved in service and, in area service and things, the 12 concepts, like I was talking about the big book, they tend to just come alive, and they have, there's such wisdom built into them. Our founders were so wise to develop those principles, the steps, the traditions, and the 12 concepts. It means we can actually meet in loving and harmonious ways. And having visited the United States a few times now, I was over there in April, and I see wonderful examples of people living the steps, traditions, and concepts. I see it here too, of course. I just want to thank Janice for chairing this meeting, and also just thank Gordy. I didn't talk much about Gordy, but Gordy was kind of there around that time that we were I was in Darwin, and we were camping, and he was the old timer that was there in the background, and we need our old timers, and I'm very grateful for that relationship. And it's actually very great. I'm actually really pleased that I've been able to find this online meeting, and that Gordy's, here. I remember him talking about it back then. This is 97, and it would have been a very new concept. I think the internet was only really up and going around 94, 95, something like that. So online AA was quite a new concept, and I'm a bit sad that it's only just now that I've actually been able to find it. So I'm very grateful. I just want to finish by saying I want to welcome those who are new and or who've recently returned. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Enjoy the ride. It is, for me, it has been the most amazing experience and continues to be the most amazing experience. I really have had the grace of God. I've gotten involved. I try to stay in the center of AA. I try not to boundary ride. I don't boundary ride. I stay in the center of AA. I do a lot of face-to-face meetings. They're very, very important to me. And it is a real honor and privilege to sponsor people, and to, I'm always thrilled when people ask me to sponsor them, because it just means I get another opportunity to help someone, and I'm very grateful for that. So I'll leave it there, and just want to thank you again. Thanks very much.